We can hop in, Sammy. Yeah, we're good.
Yo, welcome to my summer lair. I'm your host, Sammy. I have no hoop dreams because I'm more hoops than hoops. Yunnan. Tragically, this is true. This episode is set in River Rouge, Michigan, where a high school basketball team has a tradition of often dominating the circuit. In the 1950s, legendary high school coach Lofton Green led the racially integrated River Rouge High School Panthers to a record number of state championships in a league of otherwise segregated schools. You know, in the NBA, we often talk about the Lakers and Celtics because they won so many championships. This is what the River Rouge High School Panthers did. They win, and they win a lot. That impressive past is one thread in the basketball documentary Rouge, which is making its international premiere at Hot Docs. The glory days of the past bump up against the present with a fresh team. The Panthers are led by NBA prospect legend Geeter. Director Hamoudi Jafar is shooting the 2019-2020 season. The cinematic way he and his team shoot the basketball scenes is beautiful. It's just stunning. Okay, yeah. I'm a basketball guy, but this is more than just a basketball documentary. This is about resilience and how Detroit hustles. This is about community and about connection. It's about faith and it's about hope. All of these themes naturally flow in my conversation with director Hamoudi Jafar and Panthers player legend Geeter. Rouge is playing at Hot Docs. If you've never heard of River Rouge, Michigan, that's exactly why you should go. Through this documentary, you get a window into this neighborhood, which it turns out it really isn't all that much different from yours. Stephanie, hit that deep three, if you please.
Sound, the final frontier. My summer lair is an enterprise, a pop culture voyage with a continuing mission to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new creators and celebrate established producers, to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. And now here is your host, Sammy Yunnan.
Since there are two of you, I want the audiences to hear your voice. So can you guys introduce yourself and tell me who your favorite Pistons players are?
So my name is Hamoudi Jafar, a filmmaker from Southeast Michigan, from the Downriver area of Detroit. My favorite Pistons player, man, all time?
Well, I'll give you a couple of players. Like, I'll make it easier on you. Like, there's a huge list.
Yeah, there is. I would say for me, it's probably just because as a kid, I loved Grant Hill. But probably Isaiah Thomas for me. I'll say Isaiah Thomas.
That's a classic. Yeah, good one.
My name is Legend Jeter from Detroit, Michigan, currently enrolled in Eastern Michigan. And I'll say my favorite Pistons player is Isaiah Thomas as well.
All right, nice. You guys like the old school bad boys. All right, so since I am talking to a couple of bad boys, why don't you tell me where that enthusiasm comes from, like, as basketball fans? Like, was the game introduced to you by your dad, or was it an uncle? Was it watching a certain player like Isaiah? Legend, we can start with you. Like, what sparked your love of the game?
I actually started my life playing football when I was younger. So, you know, I played that for a couple of years, and then, you know, watching my brother and sister grow up, they was playing basketball, so, you know, that kind of sparked it a little bit for me. And then on top of my father, you know, him in his younger years, he was also a basketball player, soon to be a great basketball player, but, you know, stuff changed, so that also sparked it.
Do you still play football at all?
No, I'm straight basketball.
Straight basketball, all right.
Yeah.
For me, I think, man, it's, you know, I'm a child of immigrants, so my parents settled in this area called the Downriver community, which is where River Rouge is. And basketball, like, is pretty much where I gained acceptance and friendships. And that's kind of where I started to learn a lot of things as a young person. So I would say probably when I was 10, 11 years old, you know, the mid 90s, you know, the Fab Five at University of Michigan was like, that's where my fanhood started. It was coming off the years of the Bad Boys and the Pistons, and then, which I don't really remember, to be honest with you. Like, those memories are very, very vague. But the Fab Five at Michigan, for me, was that's where my fandom with the game really started, and then just playing it as a young person growing up.
The Fab Five really felt like the beginning of swagger. We didn't have that word yet, but that felt like with the shorts and the black socks and everything, like,
it was.
You know?
It was, brother. And not only that, like, that's what makes the River Rouge story so interesting, because to me, those late 90s teams of the River Rouge High School Panthers were an extension of the Fab Five, like, on the high school circuit. And a lot of people don't know, like, there's so many things we couldn't squeeze in the documentary because it can become a little too nuanced, but they were the first high school basketball team in the country to get like a sponsorship from a brand. Like Adidas was, do you know who Sonny Vaccaro is?
I saw the name in the credits. He got a special shout out. Like, so I'm like, you're talking about like Michael Jordan, Sonny Vaccaro, right?
Yeah. And a lot of people don't know this, but like Sonny Vaccaro, he was obviously a legend at Nike in the 80s, and he ended up having a contract dispute and ended up with Adidas in the 90s. And one of his major projects in the 90s was like pioneering sponsorship on the high school level. And Lamonte Stone, you know, the head coach of the Panthers in the film, was the head coach of the late 90s teams as well with River Rouge. And Sonny V identified those teams, the Panthers of the late 90s, as one of the first teams to sponsor. So Sonny Vaccaro is tied to the story, which is really interesting as well. But yeah.
Just to give people context, like Matt Damon recently played Sonny Vaccaro in Air, the Ben Affleck movie, which is on Prime Video. Yeah. Like Sonny Vaccaro does have a cultural footprint. He's not necessarily a coach or a player or anybody that would you have a trading card or anything like that. But his contribution to basketball is huge.
Yeah, he's a cultural icon. And like, that's what's so interesting about this story is there's so many layers to it that are just undiscovered. Mm-hmm. Like not even obviously the green years of the past, like during segregated times when they were an integrated school. But like the late 90s teams were ranked nationally across the country in the top 25 USA Today poll. They were sponsored by Sonny Vaccaro and Adidas. They had their own sneakers. They had a beat writer that only covered their team. You know, they had a local television production team here in Southeast Michigan that was doing play-by-play at their games like twice a week. So they were on a high school level, that's what I mean. Like they were really a cultural extension of the Fab Five, at least locally, you know, and nationally at that time.
Mm-hmm. Legend, were you aware of all of that history when you joined the program and started playing basketball? Because it's already enough pressure to play like high school basketball, right? And, like compete at that level. But now you're joining a program that has this dense, impressive history. Were you aware of all that history?
I actually wasn't aware at all. I recently just found out about all the history watching the film, if I'm being honest. You know, after the film showed me a lot of history I didn't know about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course, I knew about Stone. You know, Stone was around when I was in 7th, 8th grade. So I was always going up to the high school working out with the guys. So, you know, that wasn't really no pressure. You know, just something I was always doing as a young kid working out with other cats. So, but, you know, like I said, my brother and sister, you know, watching them play basketball. And then my brother actually went to Rouge.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I stayed in River Rouge. So, you know, the history with Stone, you know, I kind of knew about. But the Lofton Greens, and I kind of knew about Brent Darby a little bit after I got to River Rouge. So I didn't know that much about it.
How do you feel now that you've been able to contribute to that history? Because that's an impressive legacy. Like, you're one of the Panthers.
Yeah. I mean, I feel great, you know, just to being a part of that. You know, who wouldn't feel great being a part of that type of program? You know, it's a great program. I wish I was there even later to really know about, you know, to really play there, you know, to really have won something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that would have been something big. Besides that, you know, it's just a great feeling knowing I'm a part of something, you know, huge.
So for both of you, like, why did you decide to make this film, or why did you participate in this film? Like, what was kind of the interest? Yeah, so it's cool you have this program and they're, like you said, it's extension the Fab Five, but what's the reasoning or the thinking behind making a movie like this, a documentary like Rouge?
Well, for me, it was, and a lot of people don't know this, but I actually had gone out to, and Legend obviously has heard this a million times now, but I went out to film a guy named Amani Bates, who was a prospect at the time. He was the most probably highly touted prospect nationally. He was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and I was going to film him that. And I was denied access to his locker room, you know? So by default, ending up in the River Rouge locker room was just, it was a very like serendipitous sort of chain of events that led me back there, because I grew up downriver looking up to Brent Darby. I grew up watching them on local TV. I grew up reading about them in the paper, you know, those late 90s teams. And then 20 years later, when I had really kind of forgotten about them, landing in their locker room by default just felt like I was supposed to be there. And when I heard that Brent Darby had a son, and mm-hmm. and that his son was there playing for his dad's coach, I mean, at that point, like, I couldn't have scripted that. You know what I mean? So I think that just kind of took over and kind of consumed me. And then Legend and his team went out and won that night. And they beat Amani Bates, the kid I had gone out to film. You know, Amani's in the NBA now, plays mm-hmm. for the Cavs. And when I fell down like a rabbit hole of research that next week and realized there were the Lofton Green years of the late 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s, and realized what they had accomplished and how nobody had really remembered, or at least most locally had forgotten, and nationally people didn't even know, internationally people didn't even know about the program and the history. It just felt like I had a duty to, I had a duty to tell it. You know, I felt like I had a responsibility because I was from the area and familiar with it on an intimate level. So I, you know, just really didn't have a choice, I feel like.
And for you, Legend, why did you say yes to making the documentary?
If I'm being honest, I don't think it was a question.
No, it didn't.
It wasn't even a question. It was just something that happened. Like he said, you know, the first day he wasn't even there to film us. You know, it was before a game. He ended up just coming in the locker room with cameras. And, you know, the whole team, I wouldn't say we were shocked, but, you know, because we was focused and game ready. So we didn't pay no attention to it. And we just went out there and played and won. And then after that, seeing Moody at our practice asking to film us, you know, it was just something we did. Like, he said he wanted to film a documentary on us. Why not? Why not accept it? You know, he seemed like a great guy. And I'm pretty sure Stone felt the same way. So, you know, he just let him do it. And the team didn't have a choice but to go with it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, no, do you guys want to do this? Or do you not want to do this? It's just that this is going to happen, you know. So the rest is history, honestly.
Legend, have you seen Hamoudi's jump shot?
Have you seen it?
I don't think so, Moody. I don't think I have.
Man, I've been keeping it hidden, Sammy.
Okay. I wanted to know from an established player, like, it's how your skills are.
It's slept on. It's for sure slept on. But I'll introduce it to Legend in a pickup game soon, for sure.
All right.
Dang, we spent the most time in the gym together. That's crazy. I really never seen it.
Oh, man. Okay. Because it's always, I find that sometimes difficult to resist. Like, when you see a ball just kind of in the corner, right? Yeah. And you're in the gym, you just want to, like, pick it up and just shoot it anyways. No matter where you are. You might be from center or something, but you want to shoot it, right?
I definitely did. I definitely put up some shots here and there, but we were so locked in, Sammy. So locked into the creative, so locked into making sure we weren't missing moments. You know what I mean? Like, there's so many great human moments in the film, and that was because we were just as locked in as they were on a daily basis at practice and the games. Kind of like, just like how they're locked in basketball wise, you know, we were locked in obviously from a filmmaking perspective. But definitely put up a couple for sure. And they went in too.
Good. All right, good. Yeah. And I want to touch on one of those human moments, because there's a scene, it's a very small scene, but it's a very powerful scene with Squeak, who's the team, I guess, equipment manager. And one of his jobs and one of his roles in the documentary is explained is that he fills up the water bottles for all the players, right? So he puts all the ice and he fills in all the water. But as he's filling it up with ice and water for all the different players, he prays over the water. He prays for the player. He prays for the team. And faith and prayers seem to be one of the pillars of this Michigan community, or at least this team. Were you praying as you made Rouge in the same way that Squeak was praying over the water and the ice?
I mean, I'm a man of faith. You know what I mean? And I was raised a Muslim, but I've obviously grown up with every faith imaginable. I grew up in a very diverse environment. And, you know, we all speak the same language in that regard. And I think ultimately, I believe it's important to have faith and to be close. And the community of River Rouge is just an incredibly special community. You know, like the resilience is next to nothing I've ever seen. I mean, I relate it to different communities that have to overcome so much, obviously, like around the world, but just through an American lens, I guess, from a community perspective. And yeah, man, like Squeak is an incredible human being. He's got an incredible soul. And I think that is the consistency that I fell in love with across all the people I came across, you know, from River Rouge, within the community, within the locker room, within the parents and, you know, the faculty and the teachers. And it's just, it's very much consistent across the board there.
Mm-hmm. And Lenjin, you know this from playing basketball, like it's sometimes about faith. It's about grace. You hope that the shot goes in or you get a last minute foul call. Like there's always like a little bit of like hope in terms of playing basketball.
Yeah, it's a lot of hope. And then again, it's a lot of skill, you know. You know, when it comes to faith, I'm also I'm a big fan of God, you know, the man above.
Mm-hmm.
So of course, praying and, you know, having him included in things is the best way to go. So, you know, of course, our team prayed before every game. As you see in the film, Squeak prayed over the water. I'm kind of sad that even happened because I didn't want anybody to know the secret to the special water he made. I didn't want anybody to know the secret to the special water he made. He never told us to pray. He never showed us his secret sauce. So I didn't want nobody else to see it. But seeing it, you know, it's kind of amazing because Squeak had the best water ever. He had the best water ever. So
holy water.
That was just something big. The holy water. The mm-hmm. best water ever, I promise you.
And you've already touched upon Sonny Vaquero. There's two other gentlemen that we got to acknowledge who are involved or are part of the documentary. And one of them is Michigan State basketball head coach Tom Izzo, who's basically Michigan royalty. Is that the best way to put it?
Like, yeah, he's the godfather, bro.
Yeah. So how does somebody like in his position see the game? Like, how does he see the River Rouge players and the program? Because his perspective is completely different than like what you and I would see. So how does the godfather see this game and these players and this program?
Yeah, I mean, Coach is from the state of Michigan. So he grew up looking up to Lofton Green because of all the state championships they were winning in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. So that was his hero. That was one of his, you know, I guess, mentors that he looked up to, of course, coming up wanting to be a basketball coach. And then from a recruiting lens, you can't be a college coach in a university in the state of Michigan and not know about River Rouge because, mm-hmm. you know, just the amount of student athletes that have come out of the program to play Division I basketball, you know, is just untouchable. So yeah, of course, like Coach is like, he connected it all the way from Green to the present as well, because he's always recruited out of that community and out of Southeast Michigan in general. Like a lot of basketball players come out of Southeast Michigan, not just in River Rouge, but in the out of the city of Detroit, out of Ypsilanti, out of Flint, you know, even on the west side of the state, out of Kalamazoo, Grand Rapids. So, yeah, I think when you're a college coach, you just really know those communities intimately. River Rouge, of course, he knows, you know.
Yeah, and then another person is executive producer Sam Pollard. Who's a fantastic documentary filmmaker. He did MLK/FBI, Atlanta's Missing and Murdered, The Lost Children, Bill Russell, Legend. How did Sam get involved in this documentary?
So a lot of people don't see the stuff that occurs behind the scenes. Like when, obviously you have a camera, you have all this material that you capture and they go on these hard drives and then you try to stitch together, you know, proof of concepts, trailers, whatever it is, you obviously try to get the movie done. And throughout that process, you're also hustling You know, like we like Razi, who's the producer on the film with me, and I would just go to different film festivals across the country and try to just meet people and introduce ourselves and just try to tell them that, hey, we have this project and this story, you know, that we are trying to get out to the world, and we believe in it. We believe it's incredibly special. So we hustled, man. We would just travel to different festivals, try to meet producers that are much more accomplished than us. And not from a skill set perspective necessarily, because we believe wholeheartedly in our skill set, but more so just obviously from a resume perspective. Mm-hmm. And what Sundance in 20, it was January of 23. And we had just come off getting a grant from the Ford Foundation that really kind of brought the film back to life. So we were editing it in New York and we were traveling to film festivals, and we connected to his colleague. Like, she was just a speaker at one of the events. Her name is Gita. And Gita was finishing speaking, and we went up to her and introduced ourselves. And then she connected us to Sam, who was her business partner. And when we showed him the materials, you know, I think he was really into it. He was really into the story. And we were just eager to bring on an executive producer with his sort of credibility to just help elevate our story. And then he gave some great input in the edit as well to help us really shape things, you know, from the subplots that we were trying to explore and the character stories and how we can better interweave it all. Because it can be a challenge, you know, telling these like historical stories while trying to stay on track with the present and interweave it all and keep the audience engaged. So that's how that sort of unfolded.
You mentioned hustling, so I want to ask you both, but I'll start with you. Like, as somebody who's lived in New York City, you've lived in LA, I think, right? You can correct me if I'm wrong, but you've lived in both those cities.
I've lived in Los Angeles. I lived in LA for a little over 3 years. I've spent a lot of time in New York, but I've never actually lived there.
Okay, thank you. So what I'm getting at is, like, how is Detroit hustle different than New York City hustle or LA hustle? There's a different vibe to the way that Detroit hustles compared to those cities. Everybody hustles in those cities as well, but Detroit hustles differently. So how would you encapsulate, or how would you share or describe how Detroit hustles?
I think it's tied to generations, like generational, I don't want to say trauma, but hardships. You know, I think socially, economically, I don't know if any city has endured what Detroit's had to endure over the last 50 years. So, you know, my dad is an immigrant from Lebanon. He came here at 15 years old without a dollar in his pocket and didn't know how to speak English. And he's self-taught and self-willed in everything he's ever done. So I think that's just been extended to me as a child of his. We've always had to figure stuff out. And that's what I think, you know, guys like Legend and people from the community of River Rouge and Detroit in general just know how to roll their sleeves up. And whatever cards were dealt, we play them, and we play them at a level that I think no one, like, we exhaust our effort. You know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. We get every inch out of everything we get, you know, that we're given, or that's handed to us and, or presented to us, because nothing's handed to us. So I think it's just a deep philosophical, but also just life experience sort of mentality of just coming up in this area. It's a very, like, you know, industrial, manufacturing, you know, I hate to overuse the term, rolling your sleeves up and just putting in the work. And so, yeah, man, I don't know if I think that's just embedded in who we are. Like, it's just how we're born and raised.
Legend, you agree with that? What is Detroit hustle to you, Legend?
He hit that right on the point, honestly. Like, he stole the words right out of my mouth, you know? You know, just like you were saying, Detroit is a tough place to live in. You got to get how you live. Like our saying, you got to get out the mud.
Yeah.
You know, it's a struggle, you know, growing up in some parts of Detroit. So, you know, you got to push yourself extra hard. Something I had to do growing up. You got to find different ways to make it out of Detroit. You know, that's how tough it is here. So, you know, that's just the dedication you have to make it further in life.
Yeah, and you've now made it further too. You're playing for Eastern Michigan University?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, how's that going? How are you finding the games and the competition?
It's going well. I don't know if you know, but back at Providence, my first year, I redshirted.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of brought me to a deep spot in my life with basketball. You know, it kind of helped me back a lot. So I'm trying to get back into it and become the person I was back in high school. So it's a struggle, but I'm getting there. It's tough. You know, it's a grind, mm-hmm. like we just talked about. So it's not going to hold me back.
That's good. That's cool. That's also a place where George Gervin, the Iceman, he played back in his college days. Right. So it's, again, you're part of history again, right? Like you're connecting with history.
Yeah.
That's a great lineage. Yeah. Iceman is a prominent Detroit player, even though he played mainly for the Spurs.
Yeah.
Legend. He's a legend. No pun. I mean, pun intended.
Yeah. He is. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
So even though this is like, we've been talking a lot about Detroit and Detroit Hustle, like you feel like this story like can connect to like a larger audience. It's obviously playing here at Hot Docs in Toronto. A lot of people in Toronto may not be familiar with a Detroit high school basketball team, but you feel like the story can transcend and connect with people outside of Michigan.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, because there's so many universal themes, you know, it's a father-son legacy story. You know, it's about breaking down stereotypes. It's about celebrating history and legacy that people don't really know about. If you're a fan of the game of basketball, I don't know how you wouldn't enjoy this story, but not only just from a basketball lens, but if you're just a fan of humans,
mm-hmm.
because it's a human interest piece, you know, like obviously we explore some very intimate and personal subjects and personal elements of everyone's journey. And, you know, everybody that was involved was very brave. And I think that is something that wider audiences would certainly celebrate and I think commend. So yeah, man, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I think the fact that it's from this small sort of forgotten about or undiscovered in a way community and place is what makes it so unique and what makes it so universal for wider audiences, because who doesn't root for, you know, the underdog? Who doesn't root for anyone that has trials and tribulations that they have to overcome? Like, so from a thematic perspective, I feel like everybody would root for that and would enjoy the experience and the entertaining side of it. You know, the way we shot it, it's so cinematic and it gives such an interesting, unique lens to basketball from a locker room and on the sidelines perspective, but then it's also a human interest piece that has history.
Yeah. So, I like the John Woo kind of slow motion way you shot the actual games too. So you're in the games basically, you know what I mean? So
yeah. And the slow motion stuff was like, cause basketball is so, I don't know. It's like when it's nailed, like when it's played at such a high level and it's played the right way, it's like symphonic. It's beautiful. It's like the ballet. And that was what we were trying to go with some of the slow motion shots, was being able to celebrate those intricacies and those details and how beautiful it can be when it is slowed down, you know, because you don't see it shot that way typically.
And I know too, like having been to many NBA games, the NBA games are fast, but when I've gone to like an NCAA game, like for March Madness and stuff, they're all like 19, 20, 22-year-old kids, and they're zipping across, and it took a little while to adjust to the speed of it because it was much more faster. So I can imagine for high school too, like that speed is much more quick, right, compared to like an NBA game where there's veterans who are like, look, I got a guaranteed contract. I'm shuffling a little bit on this play, right? I'm not going to move as much.
Yeah, because you're trying to. This is like for a lot of these kids, it's their last hurrah, right? So you're giving it all you got.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely the style of play is different, you know. And then it's entertaining in its own right and on that level, you know. It is definitely very specific and different, but it's just, the game of basketball in general is just such a beautiful, beautiful game, and it does so much, and that's the other element of this film and this story, that it's deeper than basketball. You know what I'm saying? And ultimately, you know, that's what I think makes it so special.
And so last question, legend, for you, watching the documentary and you see the seniors, the guys from the teams in the 60s and the 70s, and they're talking about the old school days and they're reminiscing and they're laughing and they're telling stories and things like that. You actually have a record of this one season, right, with this documentary. Mm-hmm. What is it like to have like a record like that where you can look back and then see your friends and like asking girls out to the prom and like all like to have a record of your life like that? What something that those old seniors, they don't have, right? So that's kind of special. What is that feeling like?
It's a great feeling, you know, to have a special memory in my life, or an extra special memory in my life. Just knowing that we made it far that one season, wishing we could have made it further.
Mm-hmm.
It's a blessing, you know, I'm always blessed and humble, but per usual, just got to move on from, you know, what happened with it. And, you know, go forward with it. Just wish more could have happened. But, you know, it's a blessing to have, you know, yeah, just a blessing to have that memory.
It's like a badass home video.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's like a real badass home video.
Yeah. Is that going to be the documentary tagline?
I hope no. Actually, that won't sell.
Actually, Hamoudi, can I ask you one last question? I'm curious about your experiences because you did the video for the Cavs, right? Like, I think it was like an introduction video. You had a number of Cavs players a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And you even worked, I think, again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you worked for Quicken Loans, or which is, I think, is Rocket Mortgage now. The Cavs and Quicken are all both owned by Dan Gilbert, who's now been buying up chunks of Detroit. When I was in Detroit, actually, I was talking to somebody. And they were like pointing out like Dan Gilbert owns that building, and that building. I was like, oh man.
Yeah.
So
50% of the skyline.
But I was just curious what your like perspective is, because you have this like Dan Gilbert connection working with the Cavs and with Quicken Loans, and now he's buying up chunks of Detroit. So I just wanted to curious what your perspective is his investment, I guess, for lack of a better term, in Detroit.
Gosh, I mean, look. So for me, it's unique because I think people will have their own opinions on gentrification in downtown Detroit, right? Rightfully so.
Because
mm-hmm. Obviously when big money comes in, cost of living goes up, things like that, right? So There's an element of that conversation that I have my own opinion on that I won't dive too deep into here, but from a broader perspective, you have to understand that if you're from this place, there wasn't anything going on in 2005, 2006. You know, I went to college at Wayne State during that time. And when I think of like Detroit 20 years ago to where it is today, I can't help but tip my cap to it, because of course it's brought some vibrancy, it's brought some energy, it's brought some industry that was gone. It wasn't there. You know, when the auto industry shrunk the way it did through the 80s, it was the end of like a 30-year run that just, there was a massive economic decline. I mean, the city had to go bankrupt. I mean, there was a bankruptcy that they filed for. So to go from bankruptcy to where it is now, you can't help but at least be I can't not be positive about that. I guess that's the one thing I would say. And you know, I come from nothing, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, I come from nothing. So ultimately, I made money doing mortgages. That's how I use that money to invest in myself, to try to do short films and short documentaries and to show my skill set. Like, I had to invest in myself, and without mortgages and Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage, I don't know where I would have gotten that. Like, it wasn't a lot of money, but enough to be able to at least build a little portfolio so I could try to get more work and grow my network and get access to the cameras that we had on this documentary. So without Rocket and Quicken, for me personally, and that tie to Dan and those guys and what they're doing, like, I wouldn't have been able to probably advance my filmmaking career the same way. Now, my experience is unique and different, I don't know many people that use mortgages to make movies, but that's just been my lived experience and my journey. So it's a little more unique, I think. And yeah, I mean, I'm without that, I don't know where Detroit would be. So I certainly tip my cap because I think there's more pros than cons.
There's a vibrancy to it now. Last time I was there was like 2010, 2011. So it's been a few years. And so that distance, when I'm coming back now to it, and yeah, sure, I'm just a tourist and I'm just hanging out. But you can see there's a little bit more vibrancy. There's a little bit more hope to some of the things that people are doing. And it goes back to the Detroit hustle, right? Where I think that hustle's kind of been sparked again and renewed. And people are trying different things.
I think it's important to ensure that if there are bigger corporations and things coming into the city, that there's money being fed into the neighborhoods. Like, that's what I'm really passionate about and need to ensure, like, we need to ensure as a community that we're doing that, because the Detroit School District needs it. You know, there's been a lot of school districts that have been shut down. I mean, River Rouge was supposed to be shut down. You know, so the economic side of it cannot be ignored because it's in dire need. So, but things are slowly but surely spreading into the neighborhoods, and it is starting to make an impact on the school districts and the neighborhoods. And so hopefully it just continues in that direction.
Thank you so much, guys, for like hanging out, getting into basketball. Best of luck, legend, with the future seasons as well.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Hopefully you get to the NBA is the dream, right?
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Sammy.
Thank you.
Yo, that was the director Hamoudi and legend, who's one of the basketball talents in the Hot Docs selection, Rouge. I'm Sammy, host of My Summer Lair. I close this My Summer Lair conversation asking about Detroit's renewal and gentrification. If you're a My Pal Sammy reader, my newsletter, you know I recently visited Detroit shortly before I recorded this conversation. And I've seen this gentrification up close. And I've heard the local stories of how it's tailoring this unique American city. In Toronto, where I live and where I work, gentrification is terrible. It means we lose Big Slice or Honest Ed's. Prominent local landmarks just erased, like the way a magician makes things disappear with the wave of his hand. In Toronto, gentrification sucks because what we lose often is better than what we gain. Here, gentrification is not making the city better or cooler or even distinct. Yet in Detroit, gentrification symbolizes renewal. There's a hope and a bold return on the initial investment. With gentrification, there's always the danger of getting it wrong. And Detroit is aware of that danger. You heard Hamoudi talk a little bit about that. But it remains committed to creating a customized future. All of this is why I found this documentary Rouge and its special community in River Rouge, Michigan so gratifying. Yes, it's basketball. And yes, I'm a basketball fan. But it's the hustlers and hopes that make it stand out. Hustlers and hopes is gentrification. Gentrification isn't just demolishing a landmark for a bland condo. Humans can gentrify their hoods. They can inject soul into dry bones. They can be life. That's amazing. That's what the high school basketball kids at River Rouge have always done. Life. There's more to talk about with all of this. I hope you agree and sign up for My Pal Sammy, a weekly pop culture newsletter brimming with hot docs, recommendations, and sarcasm and basketball and so much more. Go to mysummerlayer.com/subscribe or Google My Pal Sammy Substack and sign up right now. Thank you for listening to me in the Netflix world. Hoops, yo.